Welcome to the Film Experience Podcast. This is your co-host, Murtada, and I am here with Nathaniel.
Good morning, and we are recording this on Easter, so happy Easter.
Yes, and this is another all listener question podcast. So thank you for everyone who sent us questions. We are going to try and answer as many as we can. And we
like got a speed round to get through the hour.
Yes. So since Cannes is in the ether and they just announced the lineup for this year's festival, which starts next month. So we thought we could answer. We got a couple of questions about Palme d'Ors. So let's start with those. Does that sound good, Nathaniel?
Great.
So Charlie asks about the Palme d'Or, and he says, how do you think this decade's Palme d'Or winners stack up compared to the 2000s? And he has another question about why don't they get nominated for Oscars? So, and then we have a third question from Archon about, you know, what's our least favorite Palme d'Or winner? Which I love a shady question.
I mean, I don't really, having a least favorite, I'm not sure I have a recent least favorite. I generally think the ones that win are at least good.
Mm-hmm.
If not, you know, something that I would pick.
Yeah.
For example, like Barton Fink.
Uh-huh.
Coen Brothers. I know that has many fans, as do basically any of their films.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it's one of their lesser efforts. I mean, it has elements that work really well.
Mm-hmm.
But it also, there's something about it to me that's a little off-putting, a little like cocky.
Yeah.
I
remember nothing about it.
But, yeah. Like, it doesn't have the staying power for me that many of the Coen brothers' best films have.
Mm-hmm.
So that's not one I love. I also think The Mission from the 80s is kind of a snooze. Sorry to fans of The Mission. But lately, you know, I either haven't seen them. Oops, like Winter Sleep, I'm not. I can't with Nuri Bilge Ceylan. I'm sorry, everyone. I've tried.
Mm-hmm.
The 3-hour talky Turkish auteur dramas are not really for me.
Yeah. I mean, I agree with The Mission. When I was thinking about this, The Mission is something that I've seen and I sort of like, what? And like, especially for movies from the 80s, that's a movie that was nominated for the Oscar too. And like, nobody even thinks about it or talks about it today. I think Deepan is another one. It's my least favorite Odiard. And then it won over Carol. So come on now. So that's the least, maybe a least favorite one.
I will never forgive Xavier Dolan for the rumor that he was not good with Carol.
Yeah.
Throwing a wrench into that jury.
Me too. But usually there is like, yes, there is one. I can tell you some of my favorites, which is the opposite, which is not what we're doing. But there's usually, yes, I would not have voted for this one from that lineup. But, you know, for the most part, they're fine. And then the other question that we got, which is like, compare this decade with the last decade, the 2000s to the 2010s. I think they have I don't know, 4 or 5 great winners, and then like, I don't know, some winners that you're just shrug at. So like, I love Uncle Bunui and Blue is the Warmest Color and Amour, and Shoplifters from this decade and last decade. Like, The Class was great. The White Ribbon is great. 4 Months, 3 Weeks is great. But then there are movies, A Dancer in the Dark was a great Palme winner. But then there are movies I haven't seen, like Elephant or The Sun's Room. And then there are ones like, like Fahrenheit 9/11, which was, you know, of its time, but as a piece of filmmaking, it's just like, eh.
Yeah, basically same, but I would probably have to go with the aughts over the current decade, primarily because The Class and 4 months, 3 weeks and 2 days and Dancer in the Dark are some of my favorite movies of that decade. So even though the others maybe aren't as strong and maybe overall the 2010s have been slightly better, but those three movies I cherish so much that it's hard to like look at that decade and go, nah.
Yeah.
And if you want to talk about like a string of Palm winners that are all really good, they had, you know, and it, you don't usually talk about consecutive things with Cannes because the jury changes every year.
Yeah.
So you can't, it doesn't really help to say, well, they really had good taste this time period, you know? But I think that run from like 2007 to 2013 actually is really, really strong.
Yeah. They did, they made some great choices there. Yeah.
Yeah. So half and half. Let's just say it's about par for the course, these two decades.
Yes. And then the question about why do they not get nominated for Oscars? I think they do, like, especially in the last few years, like not maybe in Best Picture, but The Square and Shoplifters and, you know, and Amour and The Tree of Life were nominated for either Best Picture or Best Foreign Language Film. Like the movies from Cannes, maybe they don't get nominated for Oscars all the time, but they do get that worldwide release and people talk about them and they, for the most part, they get to be seen. So there is a correlation and that's why Cannes is important.
We're not talking about them winning awards. We're talking about that they get the recognition that helps them to be seen everywhere.
Yes. Yeah.
But I think mainly the reason people don't talk about the correlation or don't believe there is they just have a very different, modus operandi. They're after very different things. Cannes is trying to, you know, their reliance on the masters, they're very sort of, you know, highbrow and international, whereas the Oscars is, I think, more trying to reflect the zeitgeist, the mainstream zeitgeist of what is quality in any specific year. Even though we all have wildly varying feelings about what means quality in, in feature films.
And, like, the thing that I really sort of, like, does not stand well with me when American publications sort of cover Cannes is, like, what happened last year when they said Cannes was terrible and Venice was great. And the only way you can sort of say that is because Venice had more Oscar movies and more American movies, where Cannes had great movies last year, Shoplifters, Burning, like the list goes on, movies that we talked about for the rest of the year. Like they showed in Cannes in May and then they went all over the world and people started seeing them and talking about them. And at the end, when you sort of look at the year, you see so many movies that people have loved actually showed for the first time at Cannes, even though besides Black Klansman, they were not American.
Yeah, and you always get that with the media. Like, if they don't have, like, a lot of films from the States, it's like, oh, it's a weak year at Cannes, which is so tacky of the media, but what are you going to do?
Yeah, and also when they're like, oh, there are no stars for the red carpet, I'm like, hello, first of all, the stars go to Cannes even if they don't have movies. They just go because all of them have beauty contracts and they want to walk that red carpet. So they're going to be there. And you know what? I don't know. Fan Bing Bing is a star. She's not American. I want to see her. Like, it's just like our star is only American.
Yeah, no, that's exactly, it's the same thing with the films. It's like, I'm sorry, Julia Binoche, Fan Bing Bing, like these are major, major international stars. Just because they're not from the U.S. doesn't mean, oh, there are no stars on the red carpet, you know?
Yeah. Well, somebody who is really going to be at Cannes this year and we've got a question about is Xavier Dolan. So Ishmael says, are you happy, shocked, confused, or nonplussed by Dolan's return to the Cannes competition?
I mean, how could we be confused? Because he's there virtually every movie he makes. I think Tom at the Farm skipped Cannes.
And the last one from last year also skipped Cannes, whatever that was, that nobody saw, the one with Kit Harington.
Oh, yes. The terrible, his worst movie, for sure, yes.
You've seen it. One of seven people in the world who have.
It is truly terrible. That's all I want to say about it.
He's return to Cannes, go to Cannes, Xavier. Hope you have a wonderful time, but just be less loud so you don't, like, dominate the conversation. This is my one problem with him is, like, he dominates the conversation so much that, you know, some other less dramatic, less loud directors don't get the spotlight. Like, I would, you know, rather hear about all these new directors. Matty Diop is one that I'm excited with. If you look at Uncertain Regard, there's, like, five first-timers. Like, this is who I want to hear about.
Eight.
Oh, wow. See, these are the people I want to hear about, I want to know about this year. I definitely don't want to know more about Xavier Dolan.
Well, it is weird that he subsumes so much of the conversation, because what the thing I've always found, like, the strangest about his career is how much coverage he gets in the States, even though his movies have never broken through here. He's never had, like, a hit, even an art house hit.
Especially. Yeah.
Which, I'm talking purely about the States. Obviously, he's a successful filmmaker, but I'm talking about U.S. art houses. For whatever reason, even though he's made several good movies, for whatever reason, nothing has broken through.
Yeah, that's true. I'm excited. I hope his movie is great. I hope it's a return to form. I still love Mommy, despite your Carol snub, Xavier, but, you know,
I still love quieter. Mommy, too.
So I think these are the canned questions. Do you want to go, where should we go next? Should we tackle?
I want to talk about summer movies, because it's also a canned topic.
Yes.
Cannes is like the counter-programming of... Cannes is the counter-programming of summer movie season, because the media does cover it a lot, even though it's very, very art house. But I'm not sure how to say this name. I apologize. Ian Daly? Daly asks, with us only 1 week out from the start of summer movie season, what are some of your favorite summer movie watching moments? And I love this question, even though I struggled to come up with an answer at first. But I did want to bring up Bring It On, which opened in 2000. I had only very recently moved to New York, and so I was just figuring out New York summers and, you know, what you do. And I went to the beach with my best friend. We spent all day on the beach, and then we were coming home sort of, like, sandy and dry, and we decided, let's go to a movie on the way back home, and we just randomly decided to Bring It On and had such a great time, and it was one of those perfect summer days that you remember, like, the entirety of the day, and the movie being, like, the capper, because it's such a great comedy. So that's a very, very fond summer movie-going memory I have. Bring It On.
That's a good one. I remember, I think this was almost a decade ago, and I only know that because I looked up when the movie was released. So it was a very hot summer day, and I was with my friend Gary, who you've met, Nathaniel, and we were just walking around, and it was so hot. We're like, all right, we need to go in somewhere where there is air conditioning, and there was a movie theater, and we went in, and basically the only movie starting at that time was Toy Story 3, which neither of us really wanted to see, but we're like, you know what, we'll just go in and buy the tickets, and if we can just fall asleep. But the movie was so delightful, so lovely, and we had, like, the best time, and we left crying, you know, refreshed, and not hot anymore, but also crying, because that ending is so gut-wrenching. So that's, like, a favorite summer movie memory. But the thing is with summer movies, it's just like I go to the movies all the time. So like it's not like I don't know, is it summer, is it winter? Like I remember the movies but not the actual act because there's so many.
Yeah. I mean, other than right around Oscar time, I usually take a break from movie theaters for a few weeks, but I'm there all year round, so sometimes it's hard to remember that. So most of my memories, the reason that I chose Bring It On is that's a New York memory, but most of my really strong summer movie memories are from childhood, of course, when I wasn't going to the movies every week.
Yeah.
You know, so it was more like how the general public sees movies, you know?
Yes. I mean, if we go to childhood, there was the summer, and it was back in Khartoum. I don't know how old I was, but I was very young, but we got The Sound of Music as a tape, and we maybe had only two tapes to watch all summer, and we watched The Sound of Music literally every day that summer. Me, my sister, and my cousins, it was, we knew every word and every song, and we would literally watch the movie maybe twice a day. It was a crazy summer with The Sound of Music.
Oh, that's beautiful. I remember Jaws dominating a couple childhoods in my summer because it was a scary movie, so I never saw it until, like, I was older, like, a teenager, but when I was a kid, I would think about Jaws all the time just because, like, the poster terrified me so much. So, like, my brothers would always be doing the Jaws music in the pool growing up.
Yeah.
To scare me. So, like, Jaws, like, dominated summertime in a way for me. Like, long after it came out.
Yeah, summer. But now summer is all about superheroes, so we'll see. I don't know what I'm going to see this summer. I'm sure I'll see a few.
Well, superhero movies, I know you probably didn't want to answer this question, but Mark asked, do you think future generations will actually watch the Marvel movies, or are they really just in-the-moment event-type movies? And my feeling about this is the answer is no, and this is not because I don't like them, because I do actually like them, unlike Murtada. But I think if you look at the superhero genre, unfortunately, even the studios who spend all the money view them as replaceable. Like, consider the fact that we've already had, like, you know, what, had two reboots of Spider-Man within, like, you know, a 20-year span. So they're sort of made to be replaced, which is unfortunate because I don't think that's the way movies should be thought of during their conception. And also, you know, because with superheroes, they always want to recast them. So a future generation's going to have their own heroes. And I really unfortunately, I don't think they will last. That's my take on that. Also, because future generations aren't going to care enough to sit through 20 movies to get a full story.
That is true.
Yeah. It's hard enough getting people to watch older films, just one of them, even if it's a major classic, let alone you have to watch all 20 of these movies to get what people were so crazy about in 2019. You know what I'm saying?
Yes, I know what you're saying. So do we want to talk a little bit about Oscar and Best Actress?
Sure.
Because Drewcy says, 1962's Best Actor is considered one of the greatest lines up ever. Where would your heart go? And 1962 was the year where Bette Davis was nominated for Whatever Happened to Baby Jane. Katharine Hepburn for Long Day's Journey Into Night. Geraldine Page, The Sweet Bird of Youth. Lee Remick for Days of Wine and Roses, and the winner was Anne Bancroft in The Miracle Worker. And of course, if you saw that feud last year, that was when Joan Crawford went up and accepted for the on Broadway at the time, Anne Bancroft.
Yeah. That is a historically great lineup. Like, there's not a dud in the lineup. And generally with Oscar lineups, it seems like there's at least one that's like, why is that person there? And yeah, that's across the board, very fine lineup.
I would definitely vote for Bette Davis because I have seen Baby Jane 17,000 times and I've always loved it. And it's a movie, one of those movies that I talk about in conversation, like, did you like it? I do say that line a lot to people. which the line is dubbed, you know, Betty is doing Joan, but the line is dubbed by Joan in the movie. So, but it's still like such a moment. And I just love Betty in general. And I love her in that movie. So I would definitely vote for her.
I would too, but with sadness and apologies to Geraldine Page and Sweet Bird of Youth, who I think is extraordinary, actually. And in most years, I would easily hand her the win for that year.
Yeah.
But Bette Davis was like next level brilliant in Baby Jane.
Mm-hmm.
It's truly inspired. And if you think about it, it was super, super brave of her at the time. Like, people weren't doing shit like that in 1962.
No. Yeah. And it's just such a fun performance. Like, yeah. The movie is tragic, but it's also so much fun and it's so rewatchable. Like, you can, like, you if it's, you can just watch it. I could watch it every few months. It's just, and I do watch clips from it all the time. Like, even at parties, if you want to, like, have a fun moment at a party, a movie party, you can just put a clip of Bette Davis in Baby Jane and it's, everybody would like ooh and ah and have lots of fun.
Yes.
And then Drew's second part, are there any other Best Actress lineups you consider perfect?
I want to give a shout out, not my choice, but give a shout out to 1974 because it's another one that's cited as often as 62 in terms of being like super, super strong. Ellen Burstyn, Diane Carroll, Faye Dunaway, Valerie Perrine, and Jenna Rollins, all with very famous and historic performances. Would seem like any of them would have made terrific winners.
Yes. And the other one that's also cited a lot, which I agree with, is 87, Meryl Streep in Ironweed, the least favorite. But still, it's a good performance. Sally Kirkland in Anna, Holly Hunter in Broadcast News, Glenn Close in Fatal Attraction, and Cher in Moonstruck. Because I think the top, like, Cher, Close, or Hunter would have made amazing winners in any other year. And Sally Kirkland is just so linked with Oscar based on that one nomination.
Oh, and she's brilliant in the movie.
And she's brilliant, yes. Yeah.
Like, people and forget then, of course, that because of Oscar lore and her appearances at the Oscars, people, like, if you didn't live through 1987, which I did, this is literally my favorite Best Actress year because I think all five of those performances are astonishing. I think Ironweed is one of Meryl Streep's best performances. So I love all five, like, literally all five.
Yeah. I mean, I was alive in 87. I definitely wasn't watching the Oscars, nor did I. I don't think I even knew they existed, but I've seen all five movies since.
Yeah. It was such a great year. The only thing at the time, like, it was like toward the end of the 80s is when I started seeing as many movies as I could get to, you know? And at the time, like, the only performance I was sad that missed, because I love all five of those so much, was this now forgotten actress, Emily Lloyd, in this British indie called Wish You Were Here.
Mm-hmm. I've seen that movie. She's great.
Yeah, she's great in it. And she was getting a lot of buzz as, like, the most exciting newcomer. But that lineup is so impeccable that it's hard to argue with it.
Yes. I mean, the first year I really followed the Oscars and I stayed up till 3 a.m. to watch the ceremony was also a year where it was a fantastic Best Actress, and that was 1995. So Susan Sarandon, the winner in Dead Man Walking, Elizabeth Shue in Leaving Las Vegas, Sharon Stone in Casino, Meryl Streep in Madison County, and Emma Thompson in Sense and Sensibility. I think those are five fantastic performances, and it's a great, great year for the category.
Yeah, that's another one. So those are some of the best actressy years ever.
Mm-hmm. Since we are on Oscar, Andy wants to know, and this question, I guess, he has a question for you about Film Bitch, but he has a question for me about the Oscars. He's like, is there a particular film slated for release in 2019 whose award prospects fill you with dread? His is Jojo Rabbit, which I'm like, it's Taika Waititi. It might be fun. I don't know. I trust him. But the one that I really don't want to see is Fair and Balanced. Like, we just saw Vice. Do we have to see a movie about Megyn Kelly at the center of it? Fine, I guess. But that's the one that I'm not excited about. What about you, Nathaniel?
I'm going to say Ford v. Ferrari.
Oh.
Mostly because, like, it's got a lot of really strong actors in it, but it's just such a guy movie.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I like the women's pictures. Surprise!
Yeah.
Like, I think there's one famous actress in it, Catronia Belf from, I forget the name of her show on TV. She's a good actor.
Outlander,
yes. But I assume she's playing someone's wife, so who knows if she'll get more than, like, 2 minutes.
But I feel that movie is going to, like, you know, James Mangold is sort of somebody who's, right in the middle of sort of, you know, so it might be forgettable. Maybe.
But it also might be a huge Oscar hit. You never know.
Yeah.
He's been on the brink before with Oscar, so it could happen.
We have a question from Mike, which he's like, were there any selections in Nathaniel's year in advance predictions that surprised you? And I have to say, I was very surprised by your faith in The Good Liar, because that was a movie that was not on my radar at all. And I was like, that's like, what is this movie? And I'm like, oh, okay. We'll see if Bill Condon is going to return with Ian McKellen, his favorite actor, and this time Helen Mirren. You seem to really love it. Or not love it. You haven't seen it. You seem to love its chances.
Yeah, I fell for, you know, the reason they do CinemaCon, of course, is to build buzz for future movies, for the movie theaters. Mm-hmm. And I sort of fell for the hype for it out of that convention, which is an industry thing. You know, they're trying to hype you up. But then I guess I just kind of love the idea of it. And it has a good release date and good stars who are very good together. I saw them on Broadway together.
That's right.
Dance of Death. And good release date, strong studio. Warner Brothers is good at campaigning, which people don't really talk about because they're such a major studio. But they are good at Oscar.
Yeah. A Star is Born. That was their last Oscar movie, right?
Yeah.
I was also surprised by your faith in the woman in the window, because the studio that's releasing it has gone away, Fox 2000, and the writer of the book is in this whole controversy, but, you know, sometimes controversies don't work, as we have seen with the Green Book. I mean, I guess it is Joyride and Amy Adams, so I can see why you put that up there.
I mean, I only have it nominated for two things. And I should say that even though I have Amy Adams very high in my best actress list, that was sort of like a last-minute adjustment, because I was going to be perverse and not include her in the nominations. But then I thought, you know, I'm already taking a swing, you know, to have so many two older actresses and two African-American, or I guess Cynthia Erivo maybe is British. So two black women, which hasn't happened since the 70s.
That one time.
So anyway, I thought, you know, Amy Adams, they're going to default to someone. So if it's not Amy Adams, it'll be Meryl or Frances McDormand.
Yeah. Yeah. We'll see. This year, I don't know. We'll see. I have to say, I'm not like, when I look at like the movies that are coming, it's not like, usually there's a couple where you're like, wow, I can't wait to see this, but I don't know. Mm-hmm. Maybe the Hollywood PR machinery hasn't worked on me yet.
Maybe you're just turning into a curmudgeon as the years go by.
Probably. Maybe that is one of the after effects of last year's Oscars.
Mm-hmm.
Do you want to, what is, Andy's second question, which was for you, was about the film Bitch Acting winner that has bested the test of time and which has held up the least. You must know.
Well, I wish that I had them memorized, but even though I give them out, like, I do look at them on occasion, but I don't, my obsession over them is, and it is very obsessive, is while I'm concocting the nominations. Mm-hmm. I mean, I agonize over that every year. I spend so much time doing it, but then afterwards I get so caught up in the next year that sometimes I forget, you know, who I gave gold versus silver to.
Mm-hmm.
Thing. So I will say, in terms of not holding up, the thing I'm mad at myself for was, mm-hmm, way back when I did give Christian Bale a medal for American Psycho,
mm-hmm,
but I did not give him the gold. And I'm really pissed at myself about that, because even at the time when that movie was not so well regarded as it is now,
mm-hmm,
I knew he was brilliant in it, and I did give, yeah, him a medal, but I did not give him the gold. So I'm really pissed at myself because nobody, literally, including me, ever talks about who I gave the gold to that year, which is Billy Crudup and Jesus' son.
People loved that movie at the time, though.
Yeah.
It was like...
Oh, and I did too. Yeah.
Critical darling, but yeah, it's completely vanished into the ether.
Yeah. So, and I gave, like, I gave it two acting medals, not just Billy Crudup, but for Samantha Morton as well. Although I didn't give her the gold, but she also won a medal. So I think about that year sometimes, like, man, if only I had been, like, the early person to say Christian Bale should have actually won all the top prizes. So I'm mad at myself about that. But there's a lot of winners that I'm, you know, very pleased with myself about. Like, I know you were asking about acting, but I'm really still proud of Rachel Getting Married taking my gold medal for Best Picture. I'm proud of lots of things from those awards. I totally stand by Nicole Kidman in The Paperboy as a gold medalist. I'm proud, mm-hmm, of myself for that. Anyway.
Do we want to sway over to foreign language films? Because Charlie had the question about the best and worst lineups of the foreign language Oscar nominees only this decade. Thank you for, like, narrowing it down for us. The thing is, when you think about it, I always think of winners, and definitely A Separation is my favorite winner.
Mm-hmm.
What about you?
Oh, A Separation is my favorite winner too, but the question's about lineups.
Yeah.
I think, you know, even though the foreign language film lineups have gotten much, much better since they instituted the executive committee rule,
mm-hmm,
I do think there's usually still at least one movie that pulls down the average brilliance.
Yes.
Of the lot. There's, mm-hmm, almost always one.
At least, yeah.
Yeah. But I think 2012, even though Kentucky's kind of a mess, at, mm-hmm, least there's a lot to look at, because it's lots of beautiful shirtless men. Beautiful shirtless Scandinavian men for a whole movie. That's okay. But the rest of the lineup is very good. And I think, and very good too, like sensationally great, like Amour. And then I think 2017, even though this is an interesting year in that I don't think any of them are perfect movies, and none of those movies made my top 10, but I think, mm-hmm, the whole lineup is really strong.
So 2012, where in addition to Kon-Tiki and Amour, No, A Royal Affair and War, which,
yeah,
and then 2017, A Fantastic Woman won, there was The Insult, Loveless, On Body and Soul, and The Squid.
Yeah, I think 2017 is a great year. You know, there's no clear duds, like, you know, anyway, I think that year is really strong for the category, even though I don't have, like, even though none of those are one of my favorite movies of the decade type of thing.
My vote goes to 2014. There is one movie I haven't seen, which is Tangerines. But the other four, Ida, Leviathan, Timbuktu, and Wild Tales, are fantastic. And Timbuktu and Leviathan made my top 10 that year. So I love both of those movies, and the other two are also great.
That's a good choice. I also haven't seen Tangerines because I was objected to it being named the same as Tangerine. And people getting the two movies confused. And I'm like, an Estonian movie and a trans hooker comedy are two very different movies.
Yeah.
If any of you out there have not seen Argentina's Wild Tales, it is so, so fun. It's like the definition of a really great time at the movies. So I highly recommend seeing that one.
Yes. That is a very fun movie. So John T. wants to know, who is a major star, classic or modern, that you feel you have skimped on their filmography in terms of seeing key films, or you don't have an opinion on them, even though they are quite famous with cinephiles? I have a jokey answer to that, because the person I picked I don't think is famous with cinephiles, but if you look at the late 30s, 40s, and the big actresses, Joan Crawford, Barbara Stanwyck, Betty Davis, Katharine Hepburn, Ingrid Bergman, who also was very famous at the time and won Oscars and people, but nobody talks about her now. I certainly haven't seen her in any movie, is Greer Garson. But I don't think she's famous with cinephiles, or anybody's like lamenting Greer Garson today.
I love Greer Garson. I'm just going to object to this characterization. I think part of my love for her stems from the female impersonator, Charles Bush.
I love Charles Bush.
Yeah, because he loves her so much, and I was into him before I was into her. And then once I started seeing her movies, I was like, oh my God, he takes so many of her mannerisms and vocal patterns and things. He's clearly Greer Garson obsessed. So I love Greer Garson.
But who would be your answer to this question?
I don't want to say unfamiliar, because I have seen a few of her key films, but I feel, given her the size of her reputation, I do still need to see a lot more Barbara Stanwyck.
Oh, yeah.
Like, I have seen, you know, some of her most major movies, of course, like the Oscar-nominated roles and a few of the screwballs and things. Like, I've seen her in several things, but her reputation is basically as big as Betty Davis's among cinephiles, it seems like.
She's so amazing.
Definitely need to see more.
Yeah, I love her so much. And it's one of the things, like, where I think The Lady Eve, which is, I think, her most famous film, is not her... Like, I don't think it's her best. I love the movie, the Beauty and the Beast sort of movie, which she did with Gary Cooper, where she sings that song. I don't know what that movie is called. I totally forgot. But it's sort of a take on Beauty and the Beast. That's my favorite Barbara Stanwyck. And then, of course, the Thornbirds. Have you seen her in the Thornbirds?
I have, yes.
So
I saw her in the Thornbirds before I saw her in anything else because of my age.
I play that clip all the time, the one where she's like, behind this body, I'm still young, I'm still alive, I still see. So the other actor that I would like to see more of is Liv Ullmann, because this year I've been trying to rectify my Bergman blind spot, and I saw Persona and Cries and Whispers, and I loved her in both. And I haven't seen Autumn Sonata or Scenes from a Marriage or... all of those amazing movies she did in the 70s, so that's somebody I think I should see more of.
Good choice. One star that I've seen very, very few of, but I have no desire to rectify that, is John Wayne. I have seen a couple of his. I remember all my relatives, especially my grandparents, were really into him. But I just have no interest. Like, the only movie of his that I've seen multiple times is Red River, because Monty Clifton is brilliant in it. And I highly recommend that movie, but mostly I can do without John Wayne.
Yes. I do, you know, when anybody mentions John Wayne, as you just did right now, the one thing I remember is that scene from The Birdcage when Nathan Lane does John Wayne's walk. So, so if anybody hasn't seen that, just go find that clip and see Nathan Lane doing John Wayne.
You might be gay if your first thought of John Wayne is Nathan Lane.
I think so. Guilty. So
here's a related question. James T. asked, who is the greatest male movie actor of all time? It's not John Wayne.
Definitely not. But I think you sort of mentioned him, I think, right? In your answer about John Wayne.
Oh, Monty Clift.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, Montgomery Clift, I love so much. I named my cat after him, famously. I love Monty Clift. He doesn't get the respect he deserves because of Marlon Brando stealing all the thunder. But basically, those two shifted acting completely in the 50s.
Yeah. I'm just also partial to Ahmed Ashiri, so that's somebody I really love. And I loved him, you know, from throughout his journey from Egyptian movies to Hollywood and back again. So I've seen a lot of his movies.
He's a great star. One person who keeps moving up in my estimation, the more of his work I've seen over the years, because he used to be my answer to which star do you need to see more of? But I have filled in a lot of gaps with him. Paul Newman. Super, super famous, but he's also basically one of the greatest actors ever, and he does not often get listed among them. He gets listed on greatest movie stars of all time, but he's also one of the greatest actors of all time. In my not humble opinion, that needs to be rectified. He's brilliant.
Yeah, he is. What's the HUD? That's such a fantastic performance from him.
Oh, yeah. He should have won the Oscar for that, for sure.
Do we want to talk about screwball comedies? James from Ames wants to know our thoughts on screwball comedies. And he mentions What's Up, Doc?, which is a movie I love, and I think he mentions Madeline Kahn, but What's Up, Doc? Is all about Barbara Streisand. I think it's such an amazing performance from Streisand that a lot of actresses have been trying to replicate that performance. Like, if you look at Jennifer Aniston's whole career, she's been trying to do Barbara Streisand in What's Up, Doc? So,
yeah, Streisand is genius in the 70s. She really is.
Yeah.
I think screwball comedy is kind of the problem with judging a future on it is the comedy goes through all these weird cycles, and we're definitely in a strange cycle with comedy where you know, screwball comedies used to, like, the term screwball comedy, if you really look at those movies, they're basically romantic comedies.
Yep.
Only the difference is, and we started them calling them romantic comedies later on, but that's the genre. And rom-coms, I think the reason we don't get screwball comedies anymore is, like, silliness is out. Like, people don't respect silliness. And one of the things that made so many of those 1930s comedies brilliant is they were, like, totally silly in great and inspired ways.
Yeah.
Like, My Man Godfrey and The Awful Truth and, like, that sort of thing. They hold up so brilliantly.
Yeah. I think comedy now is more confessional. Like, when I think about sort of, like, what we find funny now, it's things, even though those are TV shows, things like Fleabag and Insecure, where the comedy is about the sort of writer of the show, but it's more relatable, it's more poignant, and that's sort of like the comedy that people love, or at least that gets the critical reviews these days, and that's why we don't get screwball comedies. But I think Emma Stone needs to find some writer to write her a screwball comedy, because she would be fantastic in one.
Yeah. definitely. I mean, it'll be exciting to see where comedy goes next, but it definitely goes in cycles where a certain thing is what everybody wants to do.
Yeah.
And right now it's either confessionals or the sort of raunchy, you know, comedy.
Yeah. Justifier wants to know, what do you find to be the most fascinating Hollywood unsolved mystery?
I have no answer to this question. Because the unsolved mystery I always think of is Natalie Wood's death. Because Natalie Wood was my first love as a child, watching her old movies on the TV. But I don't find it fascinating in so much as I just think of it a lot because I grew up loving her, so.
Yeah. That's the only one I could think of, too. Yeah. So, you know, tell us in the comments, what are some of the unsolved Hollywood mysteries you guys think about?
Yeah, it's a question I haven't considered, which is why I don't have an answer. Mm-hmm. So I immediately go to Natalie.
Yeah. Andrew Carden wants to know, what is our favorite Kathy Bates performance? And I would say Dolores Claiborne. I love that movie. And I love her in it. And I love actually everybody in it except Jennifer Jason Leigh. But it's a great movie and a great Kathy movie.
Interesting choice and a wrong choice. I do not like that movie or her performance in it, but I probably should give it another chance because it was one of those movies that came at it. I remember it having a really weird reception because it had a lot of like pre-release buzz. And then I don't think it was quite what people wanted or expected once it came out. So I should probably see it again.
It's very camp.
Yeah.
And Judy Parfitt is just bringing on the camp. Like, it's... So what's your answer?
I mean, it's so cliche, but it's also true. I think she's just great in Misery. But I will say this about Kathy Bates. I do sometimes find her overrated, but I do love her in, like, little bit parts that she used to get. Like, nobody remembers this movie, but I just freaking loved it at the time, was Men Don't Leave with Jessica Lange. And which I think is one of Jessica Lange's best performances. And she has a small role in that I think she's really good in, Kathy Bates. And I also think she's really good in, I totally forgot what I was, Primary Colors.
Oh, yeah.
I do think she's very good in that as well.
She's very heartbreaking, too. Like, that scene at the end where she realizes, like, you can see the disappointment even in her body language in the people that she loved. And it's a great performance, yeah.
Here's a question I don't want us to forget, since we're running out of time somehow. Pete asks, do you think Green Book's win will make the Academy reexamine the preferential ballot and introduce more Best Picture changes, as in 2009? And the reason I want to address this is my answer is, God, I hope not. They need to stop overreacting to every mistake or controversy that happens and just do you, Academy. Sometimes it works out, sometimes it doesn't. The preferential ballot also gave us Moonlight, so I don't think we should throw it out. That's my take on that.
Yeah. There, people have been calling for it to be thrown out, but to your point, I think it gives us more interesting winners.
Yeah. And yes, we had one winner that people were upset by, but the winners before that people liked a lot.
Yeah.
So my basic feeling about Oscar changes is everybody needs to chill, and if something bothers them for multiple years in a row, then yes, there should be a change.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I agree. Do we want to end on this question about New York? So Evan says, what is your favorite New York-centered movie? Do you interact with any famous locations as you go about your daily life in New York?
I'm sure that the latter part of the question, I'm sure I do, because I live in New York and walk around a lot.
Yeah.
The only thing that I can think of right offhand is, because I live in Harlem, is the Royal Tenenbaums.
Oh, yeah.
Because the facade, the outside of their house that's so memorable in that movie is very, very close to where I live, so I see it frequently. Mm-hmm. And before I lived here, my best friend also lived really close to the house for years, so I've been seeing it forever. So I do think about the Royal Tenenbaums fairly frequently in New York.
That's funny. You know, whenever there is that square where the Plaza Hotel meets Central Park and now meets the Apple Store, which is not in a lot of movies. It used to be FAO Schwartz. But whenever I'm in that square, I think of movies, not one particular movie. I just think of movies because the Plaza and Central Park mm-hmm. are part of a lot of New York movies and they shoot in that square a lot.
Yeah.
So it's part of so many movies, you know. But the movie that when I first moved to New York, I lived in the Upper West Side. And the movie that I immediately wanted to go back and rewatch was You've Got Mail, because not only is it set in the neighborhood that I moved to, but it also is just you. It's one of those movies where when you're watching it, you're like, yes, I know that spot. Yes, I know that spot. Yes, I know that spot. And it's unlike other sort of New York movies. It's not like these big landmarks. It's just a neighborhood. Mm-hmm. So that's the movie I think about most as a New York centered movie.
I mean, before I moved here, the movie I thought about most in terms of New York was Manhattan by Woody Allen, because I love that movie. I know it's out of favor at the moment, but I think it's a classic film. And but like living here, it's more what you're saying, like certain areas, you're like, oh, the movies, like the Empire State Building is another one. It's so touristy, but it's a lot of movies.
Yeah.
And Central Park in general. One thing I do love to do is see, older movies that were shot on location in New York, because, mm-hmm. once Hollywood moved out of everything being on sound stages, like in the 50s, things start going on location a lot more, or at least you get footage that's also on location.
Mm-hmm.
And there's one movie that takes place in New York that I really recommend people see just for the footage of New York is It Should Happen to You with Judy Holliday and Jack Lemmon.
Oh, I've never seen that.
It's really funny. It's a comedy, and of course both of those are brilliant comedic actors.
Mm-hmm.
But it's got tons of great New York footage. There's one moment where they're in a car and they drive around Columbus Circle. And so you get all the views of Columbus Circle, only it looks much different, of course, now, because it's, this is pre-Trump Tower and pre, you know, all the big mall situation. But Columbus Circle is another one of those areas that's very famous in New York.
Mm-hmm.
It's great to see that because it was shot in the year, so it's very contemporary. They're not dressing it up to be period or anything, and you're like, mm-hmm. This is what it really looked like.
Yeah. I have to say, a recent movie that was very recognizable to me was Can You Ever Forgive Me, because Julius Barr, which we both go to, is a character in the movie, and then the Houseworks bookstore, which was one of the bookstores that they shot in, is also a place that I go to a lot. Mm-hmm. So
that's good. Since we're recording this on Easter Sunday, we should answer a Bible question, so to speak, from Patrick Gratton, who asked, in honor of Easter weekend, was your house burning down when I brought up the Bible?
I think so.
In honor of Easter weekend, what are your favorite biblical religious films? Favorite performance in a biblical film, etc. It's not a genre that I love. I'll just throw that out there. But I do love the Ten Commandments for its camp value. I have seen it many times. Still love it, especially Yul Brynner and Ann Baxter,
mm-hmm.
who are both amazing in that movie. I would actually call Yul Brynner my favorite biblical movie performance. I love him as the Pharaoh in Ten Commandments. And I do, it's not from the Bible, but taking place in biblical times. I think Ben-Hur is probably the best of the biblical epics.
Mm-hmm.
The people who don't love Ben-Hur, or people who like pish-posho, Oscar bait epic, I firmly believe, that's my theory, they just have not seen it on the big screen, because it is one of the most impressive, like, big screen epic movies ever made.
Yeah, I haven't seen either of those movies, so... And I don't think I've seen any biblical movies. I don't know. I'll just go with an obvious answer and say Martin Scorsese's The Last Temptation of Christ, because it's a great movie, and Willem Dafoe is great as Jesus.
Okay, we have time for one more. So this is from a different Patrick, about the Criterion Collection, because just so everybody knows, in case you missed the news, the Criterion Channel has started streaming. So you can join. He wants to know if either of us have joined. The official collection is about to include its 1,000th title. Do you have a favorite film in the Criterion Collection? And is there a title you wish to see receive the Criterion treatment? Murtada?
I didn't subscribe yet because I just got Canopy, which is a free... streaming service that you get with your library card, and it has a lot of the Criterion movies, so I've been watching stuff on Canopy. The movie that I really, the Criterion Collection, I don't buy DVDs, so I don't buy them, but the one Criterion Collection DVD that I have is In the Mood for Love, and it is a prized possession of mine because I love the movie so much, and it's really, you know, there is a lot of extra things in that DVD, and it is something that I watch. But, yeah, I'm excited to see a lot of these movies from the Criterion Collection. Because, you know, I've seen, like, you know, I told you I've been catching up on Bergman movies, and the Persona and Cries and Whispers versions that I saw on streaming are the Criterion Collection ones. So that's what I've been catching up.
Mm-hmm. I have joined the Criterion Channel, though I haven't used it yet. I'm very bad about paying for services that I don't use regularly, which I'm sure many of you can relate to in this world of everything subscription-based. But the reason I want to answer this question is I just have a bone to pick with Criterion. The thing I would like to see them give treatment to is not a specific movie, but a genre. They have so few musicals. I don't know who curates for them or what they have against the musical genre, but the musical genre has a lot of masterpieces and Criterion just doesn't pay attention. So I wish they would go back through the golden age of Hollywood and do Criterions for musicals.
Yeah.
Particularly the entire career of Judy Garland.
Yeah. And they should also do more, you know, female directors, I would say.
Yeah.
I don't follow closely, so I don't know what they release. I see people get excited every once in a while, but I'm always like, oh, you know, it's something expected. I do appreciate that they go, it's not just American movies, and that they go international and do that, and that's really appreciated.
Yeah.
But, you know, do more musicals, to your point, and more female directors, Criterion.
Yeah, because every time I watch one of those in the Criterion Closet videos where they have the celebrities go in and just rifle through their collection and take Blu-rays, I get jealous. But at the same time, I'm always like, I wouldn't be able to find some of the things I want if I was in that closet.
So this was a fun conversation. We got some great questions, so thank you everyone for sending your questions.
Yes, thank you.
And let us know, you know, we've answered all these questions, so if you want to answer some in the comments, please go ahead, tell us.
Yeah, particularly things that we couldn't answer very well. Unsolved mysteries. I would love to know what you think Criterion should cover. I admittedly don't know that much about what they haven't, you know, covered other than musicals, but that's just because it's my favorite genre, so I notice that they don't cover it very much. If you have anything that you've been like, why on earth have they ignored this, please do share that. And we would definitely love to hear your summer movie going memories, your best summer movie going memory, because that was a really fun question.
Yes. And next week you have the SmackDown, right?
Next week is the SmackDown of 1972. And I will also say this again next week, but I discovered this week while preparing for it, I knew it was an unusual actress year, but this should whet your appetite even more. I did the research. It is literally the only year in the entire history of the Oscars where not one supporting actress nominee comes from a Best Picture.
Wow.
It's literally the only time it's ever happened. I did the research because I was like, wait a second.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah.
So that should make it an exciting conversation.
And it'll also make you wonder how on earth Marissa Berenson did not get in for Cabaret when literally someone always gets in from a Best Picture.
Yes. Also, that movie was nominated for literally every category it could get nominated in, you know, which is great. You know, I love it. But
yeah, it's just so bizarre that that's the only year where that's ever happened.
Yes.
Thanks for listening. Again, continue the conversation in the comments. This has been Nathaniel and Murtada.